wave antenna. And alongside of it, there are two bar magnets. And they can be brought closer or further apart and going up and down the length. And that effect on the actual signal is what I was interested in. Would that make a difference? That's basically my question.
Fascinating experiment. Now, if I was bringing ferrite materials that look like a bar magnet or maybe a very large bar magnet near the base of your quarter wave ground plane antenna, I would be creating local magnetic loading, which means the amount of inductance per length of the radiator would increase, and you would be tuning the antenna to a lower frequency. However, when you and I pick up a real bar magnet, that is not, the ferrite material that I used in my example is a kind of material that intentionally has no retentivity to it. In other words, I can put a coil of wire around it, put current through it, and I can make one end north and one end south. I can reverse the current on the wire. I can give it the opposite magnetic polarity. And every time I remove the current through my ferrite material, the magnetic field immediately disappears. However, I pick up alnico or neodymium or any of these other kinds of magnetic materials that we use today that intentionally have extremely high magnetic retentivity. Let me drop. That means that at the instant that I'm generating that material, I come out of the factory, I come out of the foundry with the material, I place a coil around it, I put a huge magnetic current through that coil, making a very strong magnetic field, and I magnetize the material. It doesn't necessarily come out of the foundry directly magnetized until I do an operation on it. Then once I've done that operation, I remove the current in that winding, and now the magnetic field stays there. That's a material that is very resistant to a change in magnetic field. Therefore, it is my guess that if you took these two large bar magnets and you bring them near your ground plane antenna, primarily what you're doing is putting short-circuiting, high-retentivity magnetic materials near the antenna, which primarily will give you capacitive loading. The fact that the magnet itself has a magnetic field, I think, is almost a secondary or tertiary effect. I think it would have very little performance. In other words, if I started off from the factory with two of the bars of material that maybe is alnico and maybe it's neodymium, and I'm about to make it into a magnet, but I didn't make the first two of them into a magnet, and I brought them near your antenna, and then the second two bars were a full magnet, and I brought them near your antenna, it is my guess that you would see very little difference between the magnetized bars and the non-magnetized bars. The main effect that you're doing is bringing material nearby that almost acts like a brass slug, if you know what I mean. It's a material that, because of skin effect and because of retentivity, is not allowing the polarity on each half cycle to reverse within the magnetic material. So I think you'd be primarily creating capacitive loading, and whether they're magnetized or not might not matter. That's a guess on my part.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's a guess on my part, but I haven't done your experiment. And so when you do it, you're going to come back and tell us what you find, and you may find some unknown effect there, John. KC2WGB. And what are you trying to do? Make the antenna more compact or look for a different kind of resonance? K2RIW Matechnet. You got it, John.
Exactly, Dick. Looking for a different type of resonance. You've answered my question. I didn't think the magnetic field itself would have much results, but it seemed to in one of my experiments, so I didn't want to chase a ghost. But I am going to look into it in more depth, and I will return and get back to you and let you know what I find. Thank you for answering my question, and back to the net, sir.
Yeah, this is the best of all worlds, John. You would start off with two bars of material that are identical in every way, except one of them is magnetized and one of them is not. And it is my guess that the magnetized one will not act very differently than the unmagnetized one, as long as the materials themselves are identical. Now, for you to go out and buy two exact same bar magnets, one of which is magnetized and one is not, that's a tough one. And I guess with some experimentation, you've got deep enough pockets, you could buy a pair of identical magnets. by various techniques, you could manage to demagnetize one of them and therefore find out if the effects that you're seeing is due to the magnetic field or just due to the presence of the material and its local conductivity itself. So you want to separate the fish from the fowl along those lines. Fascinating. Let us know how it turns out. We've now gone beyond 7 o'clock, correction, 9 o'clock, and so it's time that we go to the new people who sign into Mel's TechNet, to his website, with questions for his mailbag, as we call it. So, Mel, what kind of questions have you been getting this week? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I just have a small comment.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, John, if you need just to measure the magnetic field, I have a Gauss meter that is sitting on my bench, and I don't use it so far, so I could drop it to you.
Or John could visit the laboratory on 60th Street. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Wesley. I may take you up on that. You've made enough visits to mine. I guess I could do one. Back to the net. Let Mel get going. Thank you, Wesley.
Okay, you got it, Mel. Wait for the beep. And what have we been hearing this week?
Hey, this is K2KEY. Just reading them over. A lot of nice congratulations that I'm passing on to you. And so on and so forth. And a few boos, of course. But thank God this is a free country that they can express themselves any way they like. And, all right, let me see if I can find something that will be typical for the TechNet. Ah, here's one. Here's one from a group. We have gotten quite a number of the DISH network small parabolics that were being discarded. Do you know of any good amateur radio applications for them? I think you're familiar with those. Iron pan, take over.
Oh, yes, I own quite a few of those. The guys who get on 10 gigahertz ham radio make a lot of use of those 18-inch dishes. The guys who have portable setups where they do mountain topping and beachfront operations and so on, and the 10 gigahertz contest, which I think is next weekend, but I'm not positive of that. There's an August weekend and there's a September weekend every year, Saturday and Sunday, in which the 10 gigahertz contest takes place. And there you get the maximum number of points by talking to the most number of grid squares, the most number of miles. You multiply the number of grid squares, the number of people you talk to, and the number of kilometers between the stations, and that's how you end up with your score. So those 18-inch dishes are very popular. If you go to the website of W1 Gigahertz, Whiskey One Golf Hotel Zulu, you go to Paul Wade's website, you'll see quite a bit of information about using those dishes. You'll also see quite a bit of information about using them at the at Tom's site, which is WA1, why can't I think of Tom's call letters all of a sudden? Mine's going blank. Tom Williams.
CBA.
That's it. Whiskey Alpha 1, WA1, November, Bravo Alpha. NBA1, NBA, yes, I think that's it. You go to his website, .org, and you'll see a lot of uses of those 10 gig dishes. The way a parabolic dish works, and that's an offset fed dish that's used at 12 gigahertz, and the dish itself has no real frequency. The feed horn's got a frequency to it. But the feed horn is very reusable at 10 gigs, even though it's designed for 12 gigs. The way a parabolic dish works is that the gain of the dish goes up 6 decibels every time you double the frequency you're using it at. So that dish has got quite a bit of gain at 10 gigs. At 20 gigs, it's got 6 dB more gain, and you go up in frequency, it keeps getting more and more narrow in beamwidth and higher in gain. That's the good news. Let me drop. And that dish is a nice, rugged thing with a nice support structure and a way of holding with that arm that goes out in front. It holds onto the feed horn very nicely. As you go down in frequency, the gain obviously goes down 6 dB. I don't think anyone would desire to use that dish below approximately 5 gigahertz. It sure would be nice to using it at 1 gigahertz. Well, an ordinary horn antenna is probably going to work better at 1 gigahertz than that dish. So the dish has got some very nice use, but only for roughly definitely 5 gigahertz and above, in my opinion. Although, if you start using an array of them, just like you and I remember back in the days, Mel, when a great big loudspeaker used to be very expensive, but the so-called Sweet 16, guys used to take a whole lot of small loudspeakers, drill a whole bunch of holes of the right size and a big piece of plywood, mount all of those little small 16 of these loudspeakers in an array 4 wide and 4 high, hook them all up in series, and made a beautiful loudspeaker very inexpensively. And I guess in theory, you could do something similar with a whole bunch of those dishes. Make a Sweet 16 equivalent. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Question. If you have one of these dishes, and it's got the, I guess that LNA comes as part of the assembly. You should always see that stuck on there unless somebody broke it off. Can you modify the LNA and make use of it, or do you start all over, Dick? Over.
Oh, you hit the nail on the head. It's called an LNB, low noise block down converter. And what that block down converter has inside of it is a feed horn, and the bottom of the horn has got a little bit of a probe in this circular piece of waveguide that goes into the first preamplifier, an extremely low noise preamplifier, carefully tuned to 12 gigahertz. Lots and lots of guys have taken that assembly because they want to do 10 gig operation, made minor variations to that low noise block converter to take its center frequency that used to be on 12 gigs and move it down to 10 gigs by way of the so-called snowflaking technique, by watching it with a vector network analyzer or a sweeping signal generator, by taking tiny little pieces of copper tape, so to speak, on the end of a toothpick and sticking it in the right position on the printed circuit of the low noise block converter. They're adding capacitance, tiny amounts of capacitance, in just the right spot. Take the preamplifier that's tuned to 12 gigs, tune it down to 10 gigs. There's also a bandpass filter inside, passing only 12 gigs. And you've got to bypass that printed circuit bandpass filter. A fairly simple operation. So if you go to the right websites of Whiskey Alpha 1 November Bravo Alpha.org or W1 Gigahertz Golf Hotel Zulu.net, I think it is, but you go to each of those websites, you'll eventually find articles for how to take a 12 gig satellite receiving system and make a beautiful front end for the receiver at 10 gigahertz using an awful lot of that hardware. And so for the person who wants to do some serious microwave experimenting and save a lot of money, because those dishes are a dime a dozen, so to speak, that's a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
For those who want to save some money, that's a very good approach. You got to be a little bit careful, though, and that is that little bit of a whisker that's inside of the waveguide that is the pickup probe for that low-noise amplifier that's in there. It is very electrostatic sensitive. You got to be careful that everything you're doing is properly grounded so that you don't put an extremely small static charge on that whisker. Ordinarily, it's down the waveguide where it's very well protected. When you're making these modifications, you have to use good ESD operational performance procedures in order to not to damage that very delicate preamplifier. The actual gate inside of that first transistor is a fraction of a micron type gate, very, very microscopic, and an amount of static charge on your finger that you think is nothing, that you never knew was there, could potentially damage that transistor. So you have to have that one caveat in that tuning procedure. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Past experience sounds very handy. Four of them, like you say, they're a dime a dozen, so you have to ruin the first one. You learn by it, you just mash it up, you know, break it up or whatever, and you don't take the precautions that Dick just outlined. You didn't lose very much money, but the price is right. I see them constantly on the garbage pile. So if you see any and want to take a shot at going to amateur radio 10 gig. Is, like Dick said, a very cheap way. Amateurs like bargains, so can't beat the price with one of these 18-inch Dish Network parabolics. Okay, shall we take one more?
Let me add a couple more words to this one. You'll be amazed how much sophistication there is in that low noise block down converter. It starts off with a what's called a scalar feed. In other words, when you take the plastic housing off the front of the feed horn, you'll see multiple rings, concentric rings, and that's called a scalar feed. It's a variation of something that was invented by Mr. Potter, and he called it the Potter feed in the early days. And can't think of his call letters right now. It's a guy from Bell Laboratories who had some very nice articles on the subject. But the way the low noise block converter works is that there's two separate probes at right angles at the bottom of that circular waveguide at the bottom of that feed horn. One of them picks up a clockwise polarized 12 gig signal when it's receiving from the satellite, and the other one picks up a counterclockwise signal. The set-top box that you've got down in the house, which is feeding the coaxial cable that goes up to that low noise block down converter, has something like 12 volts on it or 18 volts. If you put 12 volts, it receives clockwise. If you put 18 volts, it receives counterclockwise. In either case, the voltage you're putting on the center conductor goes into a voltage regulator that brings it down to something like 5 volts regulated to run the low noise preamplifier and to run the actual oscillator that's in there. There's a oscillator that mixes your 12 gig signal down to something like 900 to 1400 megacycles. It's a down converter. That's why it's called a low noise block down converter.
Ceramic resonator.
Okay, so it's a ceramic resonator that is the actual oscillator. And what is that actual frequency that thing is running at? Something like 13 gigahertz. Is it on the high side, Eric, if you happen to know?
Depends upon whose model it is. Some of them are on the high side, some of them are on the low side. And you're talking about direct to home satellite. Which is actually not the KU band. It's a little bit lower.
Yeah, people call it KU band, but it runs somewhere around 11 and 12 gigahertz in that frequency region. And so when your set-top box is selecting an odd channel, which is clockwise, or an even channel, which is counterclockwise, it is really deciding to either send 12 volts or 18 volts up the cable. That goes into a sensing circuit where the voltage first is brought down to 5 volts regulated to run the actual transistors. But whether it's 12 or 18 volts, operates a switch. The switch decides to listen to the clockwise preamplifier or the counterclockwise preamplifier. Each one of those probes in the waveguide goes to a separate low noise preamplifier. And so that switching network selects which one. So you're not getting one preamplifier in that low noise block down converter. You're getting a pair of them. You could decide to have two separate polarities of your 10 gig operation if you wanted to. On the East Coast, horizontal polarization is almost the standard that 98% of the guys on 10 gigs use. On the West Coast for a while, vertical polarization on 10 gigs was very popular. Whether or not they're still doing that on the West Coast, I'm not sure. But just a little bit more information about the sophistication you've got in that block down converter. For a guy who's smart enough to trace out the printed circuit and look up the integrated circuits, the model numbers and whatever, and figure out what's going on, this little bit of information I just gave you might help. K2KEY, K2RIW.
You brought up a very good question there. Okay, you have one of these dishes. You got the box also. Usually that's thrown out along with it too. I have to have a number of them. Found a number of the boxes that would be discarded. They have a card in there that's some kind of a decoding card, I believe. Now, if you just took the converter box as it stands, put a hunk of cable on it, connect it to the dish, and aimed it at one of the satellites, easy enough, I guess, to locate which satellite, what could you detect actually in the box? Forget about, you know, going through all the rigmarole, but really, where do you begin, or what would you look for as, let's say, just to verify that it's a working unit, Dick, over?
Yeah, without the subscriber card that has been initiated, that you plug into the box, since all the satellite signal itself is essentially scrambled, on your television set, you will not see anything except
the Barker channel.
So there is a Barker channel that says, when you buy the card, this is the material you'll be seeing. And that Barker channel is, what is that, channel number two, so to speak? Eric, go ahead.
Now, it depends. If you're talking about DirecTV, it's in one place. You're talking about EchoStar or what you call Dish Network, it's in another place.
And so the set-top box takes the real IF that is coming down that cable, which in many cases is 950 to 1450 megacycles. That's the real IF set of frequencies coming down that cable. The box itself, depending on which, the set-top box, depending on which channel you have selected, it moves its local oscillator to then mix that signal at, let me pick a number, 950 megacycles. It then mixes it with another LO, beating it down to channel 3. And your actual television set itself...
None of them do that.
Say that again?
None of them do that. What they do is they go down to 70 megahertz, and there they go into a data separator. It's all digital. There's no analog. It's, you know, the days of the big ugly dish are gone.
Good point. So you're saying the real demodulation is taking place at 70 megs, which is, so to speak, the second IF, if I understand correctly, or did it get beat down to 70 megs in the first place, which would give you an image and real problem? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it goes into a data separator. It doesn't actually go into a demodulator because it's, you know, it's QPSK that's coming down.
Okay, so you do have a Barker channel. If somebody put a capacitive coupling T connector on the downlink cable, the piece of RG6 cable, and looked at the 950...
It's pretty on a spectrum analyzer.
Okay, so you've got a spectrum analyzer scanning 950 to 1450. I think, depending on how you've commanded the set-top box, you're either going to see all the odd-number channels or all the even-number channels across the 950 to 1450 IF frequency region on that cable. Is that approximately true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, you're still stuck in the big dish mode. It's digital, so it kind of looks like flat lines. You know, you would think if picture carrier and sound carrier, that kind of stuff, forget that idea. It's just one big flat line that looks like noise, but you'll see that there may be, depending upon the transponder's width, there'll be anywhere from 18 to 25 megahertz wide, those flat lines.
So each of those odd channels or each of those even channels is itself a kind of a barked head of noise, and depending on whether I've got it aligned for the odds or the evens, I will see some minor gaps in noise power in between each of those. I think there's 32 channels total, so you've got 16 odds and 16 evens, if I remember correctly. I will see some dips in that noise power between those channels when I'm scanning it with a spectrum analyzer, 950 to 1450 megacycles. Is that approximately true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yes, that's approximately true, and it'll be the strongest signal. That's the beauty of having a spectrum analyzer when you're pointing one of those dishes. I mean, the signal coming down is so strong, and as you go across it, it just pops up at you. The DirecTV satellites and the EchoStar satellites are a little bit unusual. They're not your traditional 32 transponder type of machines, depending upon which satellite, because some of them have shared services, some of them actually have satellites that are co-located with each other in the same orbital spot, so it's interesting, but usually you will find that they're loaded from one end of the band to the other.
And part of the reason why Eric said the signal is going to be so strong is because the dish itself has something in the vicinity of 30 decibels of gain, which probably means it has something in the vicinity of a 5-degree beamwidth in azimuth and elevation. You aim it correctly at the satellite and peak on that satellite, the preamplifier in the low noise block down converter has something in the vicinity of 60 decibels of gain. So you've got 30 dB of gain in the dish, 60 dB of electronic gain. There's a total of 90 decibels of gain between free space and that IF cable that you're looking at with your spectrum analyzer.
And about 170 watts coming out of the satellite.
So, although the satellite is 22,300 miles away, it's got this great big dish with probably 50 decibels of gain, giving you a huge amount of effective radiated power in the downlink from the satellite. You're sitting on the ground with this 18-inch dish, which it's got 30 dB of gain, 60 dB of electronic gain. You can see that you get a pretty big whopping signal, so it'll show up very nicely on a well-tuned spectrum analyzer. Fun signal to look at. But because of the scrambling, except for the Barker channel, none of those other channels are watchable per se. But still, that probably gives you some ideas, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, so you're saying that if you have the converter and you pull out the card, which most likely is no good anyhow anymore, and if you just hook up the box, that control box, to one of these dishes and aim it at the approximately part of the sky where the satellite possibly is, I guess it's easy enough to find out what its setting is or its bearing is, you can then find if this unit, the dish itself, is active. In other words, just to see if it's a salvageable dish. Is that correct? In other words, without the card, the selecting card, the decoding card, whatever they call it, you still can verify the operation of the dish. Is that correct? Without a spectrum analyzer, using, say, a TV set, Dick, over.
Let me answer that.
Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. Most of the receivers, either DirecTV or EchoStar, which is this network, will complain that there's no card in there. So it's best to leave the card that's there in it. If you happen to have a dish receiver, you then want to point the dish at 98 degrees. If you have a DirecTV receiver, you want to point it at 101 degrees. Those are their main satellites. On dish TV, not only is there the Barker channel, but what runs in open key is NASA Select. So you'll be able to get NASA Select if you happen to have an EchoStar dish. Back to you, Dick.
Now, most of the DirecTV satellites, I thought, were approximately to our southwest at about 25 degrees above our local horizon. So I would aim the dish in true azimuth, something in the vicinity of 230, 240 degrees, and something like 25 degrees up above the horizon. You said 90 degrees of aim. I'm a little bit confused by that one, Eric. Go ahead.
No, I'm not talking aim. I'm talking orbital slot. The DirecTV main satellite sits at 101 degrees west, and the main EchoStar is at 98 degrees west. You know, the whole sky is loaded with every 2 degrees. There's another satellite. But depending upon where you are, you have to calculate where to point your dish.
Beautiful. So he was thinking in terrestrial coordinates, and he was thinking in equatorial coordinates. Turns out that all synchronous satellites, in theory, are directly over the equator of the world. You could say it is one-dimensional real estate. You don't want the satellite to be too high or too low in altitude. You don't want it to be north of the equator or south of the equator. Real synchronous satellite orbits are one-dimensional real estate. It's a string of beads directly over the equator. And each one of these satellites, therefore, has a one-number address. So these satellites are approximately 90 degrees west of the Greenwich Meridian, but 22,300 miles up, directly above the equator. So for those who love mathematics, let me drop. You can have a beautiful science experiment calculating the three-dimensional trigonometry, so to speak, in order to say if a satellite is directly above the equator at the 90-degree longitude line. You and I live at the 70-degree longitude line, so to speak, Mel. But if you go to the 90-degree longitude line, which I guess is somewhere like Texas, but due south of Texas, directly over the equator, that's the point in the sky, 22,300 miles up, where the satellite you care is located. And then once you figure out your latitude and your longitude in, let's say, Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, a guy who's a little bit smart with trigonometry in the three-dimensional plane can figure out what compass heading in azimuth and what elevation heading in degrees he would aim the dish in order to find that satellite. Now, even if you don't
do the simpler methods,
even if you don't do all that mathematics, you just wave the satellite around, you're going to find it if you've got the right kind of detector. But for those who enjoy the mathematics of what's going on, it's a beautiful thing. Go over to you, Eric.
Yeah, there's a real simple method, and that's all the DirecTV or the EchoStar receivers. If you go to setup, and you put in a zip code, it'll tell you the azimuth and elevation at which to point your dish.
Yeah, but that's cheating. For those who love the mathematics of it, you can do it mathematically or you can cheat. You just go and get the bottom line answer, and the dish, the box will tell you that is what Eric is telling us. But there's a lot of very sophisticated electronics at a very inexpensive price in each one of those dishes. The low noise block down converter with its plastic cap over the feed horn is an extremely rugged assembly, Mel. You would have to run it over with an automobile. You'd have to hit it with lightning. You'd have to hit it with a sledgehammer to damage it. Or you'd have to put a huge spike of voltage down the coaxial cable. I think of the ones that are in the garbage can, I predict that 97% of them are in full operating condition. You don't even have to electronically test it, in my mind. If physically you look at it and it doesn't have a hacksaw cut right through the middle of that preamplifier, then you can assume it's operational, and 98% of the time you're going to be right. The dish itself just has to have the right shape. The feed horn just has to be in the right location. And as long as nobody has broken into the package, so to speak, that block down converter works.
They fail, you know.
Say that again?
They do fail because of the way they're manufactured. They are manufactured where the transistors are literally deposited on the PC board, and they're not in a case. And sometimes they get leakage and stuff like that. So I've replaced many in my day, so you really have to check them out.
Yeah, but what's the real failure rate, Eric? If 1 out of 100 is failed, I'll be amazed if it's that high. What do you think?
Oh, I'd probably say 1 out of 1,000, but they definitely fail.
Okay, so that's a prediction of 99.9% probability you've got a working one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, because most of them have been ripped off the walls or thrown away because they changed, you know, from around here, I guess, when they came in with other methods such as the Verizon Fios or whatever. They started ripping down these, abandoning them. I'm amazed. I guess they're most likely made so, I could say, cheap, so reasonably priced that don't pay to send somebody out to reclaim them. They just literally abandon it and tell you, you know, you'll feel like taking it down, just discard it. Like I say, I've seen boxes of one building over here. They changed over the whole works, and there was dozens of boxes of these converter boxes just laying there on the street, piled up with dishes and everything and all kinds of stuff. So, as you said, the price is right. Go for it. Go back to you.
I am curious, Mel. You're a collector from way back. When you saw these beautiful boxes of hardware on the street, I bet you attempted to pick up at least a couple of them. Is that true?
Oh, by the way, you can buy them new for $30 each.
I know, but Mel saw them for free, and I bet you he was tempted. Am I correct, Mel?
And you know the answer to that, Dick, because you give me the same answer. Well, of course, I got a whole pile of them piled up there, and I took a number from a pot, and oh, you know, they got a lot of great electronics in them, especially that power supply, a nice little, very small switching power supply in there. So, you can, if you want to salvage, you need a nice little power supply or whatever. A lot of things, a lot of surface mount of technology in there that you can play around with. So they're a gold mine of experimented parts, I should say. The price is right, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, the very progressive amateurs, in my opinion, are the ones who move up one decade in frequency every decade in years. Right now, the really progressive guys are probably moving to 24 gigahertz, but in the previous decade, a significant number of guys were on 5 gigs and 10 gigs. There still are a lot of them. The guys who really like building their own equipment, testing it, going out in the field, using it, going to conferences, comparing notes, writing emails to each other on listservs, like the microwave reflector of Tom, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.org. He runs a very nice listserv where among the ham radio operators, approximately 1 per 500 or 1 per 1,000 in the general population is a ham radio operator. Approximately 1 or 2 per 1,000 hams are serious microwave operators where they build their own equipment that operates at these frequencies well above 1 gigahertz. So we're talking about 4 human beings per million in the general population. That makes them the creme de la creme, they think. And so of those 1,000 or so guys on planet Earth that are very serious about their microwave ham radio, as I said, there's about 1,000 or maybe 2,000 of them. At least 400 of them are all on Tom Williams' listserv, WA1MBA microwave reflector. The majority of them know each other on a first-name basis. They pass information back and forth, 3, 4, 5 messages per day at least worldwide. If a guy in Australia needs a dielectric resonator oscillator out of one of these assemblies, and he puts out the word on the microwave reflector, 5 guys...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And that example, 5 guys will come forward and say, hey, Tom, I've got one. It's in the mail to you. Don't worry about it. These guys are sharing hardware, sharing technology, giving each other hints and all kinds of hints as to how to make the electronics work better, lining up moonbound 10-gig contacts, telling each other about the dish they're using, what they're using to steer the dish, what they had to pay for the dish, where they got it from, where they got the traveling wave tube amplifier, if they want to be a big gun and run high power. Very few of those, but as you can see, it's a whole subgroup. It's a whole sub-society that... if you're very progressive, very science-oriented, and like the higher frequencies, boy, is there a group that you can join. Tom Williams has a signature that he has on many of his emails. He writes down his name, his call letters, and after that is a sentence that says, no frequency is too high. Or he alternates that with, no frequency is high enough. As you can tell, the very progressive ham radio operators realize that whenever you go up to higher frequencies than have ever been used before, you'll discover brand new techniques for building transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, amplifiers, and so on. You'll find brand new methods of propagation. Who would have ever predicted you can get around a mountain between you and the guy that's 500 miles away by both of you aiming a 10-gig signal at a cloud and doing cloud reflection? Until you actually went out and did that, who the heck would have ever predicted that? And there's a lot of other rain scatter propagation, cloud propagation, knife edge diffraction off the top of a mountain and so on, super refraction off of the air mass that occurs beyond midnight. You get a band opening some portion of every 24-hour day on the 10-gig ham band. Crazy stuff you would never know if you didn't go there. K2KEY, K2RIW on the deck then.
It's one of the about 27 different types of amateur radio, and again, it is the cutting edge of both amateur radio and the future of communication. So, something to look forward to, looking into, because as we just outlined, you can surely get the so-called feet wet just by fooling around with some of this equipment that you can literally get Most of the hams have picked up for absolutely very little or nothing. And understand how it works, and then you can go on and start experimenting. So a good place to start is maybe with one of these already assembled 19-inch dish with all the electronics, and just to give you a you know, an insight into what is going on in the amateur radio, so-called, like you say, no end to how high in frequency. Over.
Yeah, once one of these guys becomes enthusiastic, and it doesn't take much money, it just takes some perseverance, and he learns these microwave techniques, and he figures out how to make a state-of-the-art feed horn, dish, low noise amplifier, transmitter, receiver, demodulator, and whatever. Once you learn these microwave techniques, which are extremely poorly taught in all of our so-called good technical schools, once you've got that skill, no matter where you got it from, there are companies out there that will beat a path to your door. They will treat you very well because you're a rare individual. They'll pay you well. They'll treat you well. You'll have job security. It is a whole career in itself if you want to go down that road. I did, and that's what's happening to me. I'm treated very well because I've got that skill. Why don't you go to another one now, Mel? K2KEY, K2R. Somebody wants to add something to that?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, has anybody tried shooting 10 digs at some of those geostationary platforms? Because they have very big dishes, and all that metal on the outside sounds to me like you got a reflector up there.
Well, there are guys who have bounced signals off of airplanes. I'm one of them. There are guys who have bounced signals off of the space shuttle. When it comes to bouncing a signal off a geostationary satellite, bear in mind the amount of echo you get back falls off as a range to the fourth power. Although the dish itself is large, that's the good news, the distance is huge. 22,300 miles is six times the Earth radius. It's 10% of the distance to the moon. So because the range is so great, the amount of echo power you're going to get off that geosynchronous satellite is going to be kind of small. I'm not aware that anyone has done that, Eric. Are you interested in starting such a project? K2EJ, K2RIW?
I don't know. I got nothing going. It was just an interesting thought. It just popped into my head. I was wondering if anybody attempted that, that's all.
Now, one of the things you will get a kick out of is that three or four of these guys on 10 gigs that are on the microwave reflector have chosen various space probes of NASA, space probes that are on the way to Mars, on the way to Venus, found out the exact frequency of the downlink, and with their backyard equipment, built a good low-noise amplifier, aimed their dish at the right time, in the right direction, and listened to the signal from a NASA satellite when it was, let me pick a number, 100 million miles away from the Earth on the way to Mars. There's been a couple of reports of ham radio operators doing that. You can't earn a lot of money doing that, but to listen to that weaker signal from that far away, from a piece of NASA hardware, listening to the downlink of the Hubble Space Telescope or whatever, there's a whole group of people who would be fascinated with doing that. And so it's something worth considering. There's a whole set of hobbies and education that come out of this. Why don't you go to the next letter if you've got another one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
By the way, you used to do that, except the farthest distance was the moon.
Yeah, I used to listen to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts. I listened to the ALSEP packages, the Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package that was put down by, I think it was Apollo 12. And so, yeah, I've listened to a number of these pieces of hardware on the lunar surface, as well as listening to the astronaut audio itself. You can read the article about that in the August issue. No, that was the July issue, June issue of 1972 QST Magazine. The article is entitled, Houston, This is Apollo. And so I listened to tape recordings during the time that the astronauts were not connected to the networks, and I heard some fairly candid material, which I've made, as I said, tape recordings, and it's kind of fascinating. K2KEY, if you got another one, Mel. K2RIW.
Okay, running a little bit late, but, you know, you brought up a good question. One more question. In fact, I've had this question before, and I skipped over it, but I think it's apropos to what we're discussing. Is there any legality to receiving? Now, I've heard so many different, you know, versions, but what is the legality of receiving any transmitted radio signal? Is there really, in other words, of course, cell blocks, we always hear this, but is it actually illegal for you to, as a ham, build any of this equipment that is capable of receiving these frequencies or whatever, whatever I could say some of them are scrambled? Is there an illegal process that you'd be going through if you go ahead and try to do anything with these signals, Dick? Over.
Hey, the Act of 1934 is a good one.
Yeah, the FCC's Communication Act of 1934 tries to define interstate commerce and wiretapping and whatever. So if you're sending a signal across the state line, or if you're going across counties or whatever, and you're doing what looks like wiretapping or theft of service, you could get yourself in trouble. I remember writing a letter specifically to NASA headquarters in Houston, and I said, hey, I've listened to the Apollo 15 astronauts. I've made or recordings of the downlink audio. They were not across the state line. They were not across an international line. They were in space. They were in orbit around the moon or on the lunar surface, which is not defined by the Communication Act of 1934. I specifically asked them, am I breaking any laws that you know of if I reveal what I heard from the astronauts? I made a formal letter to NASA with that question. I got a nice answer from them on other things that I questioned them about. That subject was not answered. I used my judgment. A couple of things the astronauts said, let me drop, were a little bit on the personal side. I didn't reveal that. But the other things that they said when they were not connected to the network, which was not personal, and it wasn't putting anybody at a disadvantage, I did reveal that. And I played those tape recordings to various people. So it's really, in my mind, a non-defined situation, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I have a comment about it.
Go ahead, Eric.
Although the Communication Act of 1934 has been ripped apart and changed a lot, there's a clause in it that says that, in essence, you can listen to anything you want, as long as you do not divulge the content. It's sort of like, it goes in line with copyright. You know, you can keep a copyright of a movie for yourself, but then there's a gray area of de-scrambling something. So I can't think of the guy's name, but there was this guy that came up with a code to do a VC2. And he had his meetings in Bermuda. He gave everybody tips, and then the FBI there was, of course, collecting them as they got off the plane, but they came back into the country. But in essence, you can listen to anything you want, as long as you keep it to yourself.
But where do you cross the line? If you reveal what you've heard and you reveal it to who, and what is the nature of the material, and what is the location of the emitter? I mean, if material was not intended for you, but you as a hobbyist built electronics with your own hand to receive it, and then you tell your neighbor what you heard, have you really broken the law? I mean, you're not doing it to create theft of service. You're not doing it to create libel. You're just revealing this interesting signal from an astronaut in space, and you told your neighbor what you heard, and you let him hear the tape recording. I'm having trouble believing that you would really be prosecuted in a case like that. Over to you, Eric.
Remember, when this act was written, it was just after World War One. A few years after World War One. And there was a lot of things going on in government with spying and all that kind of stuff. So it was written very broadly, and it's got lots of gray area in there. And even to this day, lawyers have a heyday with interpreting it. But and that's how actually some of the cases of copyright infringement and descrambling have gotten past the court. But if you're going to take it for the letter of the law, that means if you tell your neighbor, you're in violation of the law. But will you get prosecuted for that? You have to think about that one.
Dick, I don't believe that you ever reveal this information, anything is going to happen to you. Can you imagine whole community of United States of ham radio amateurs behind you?
Yeah, I think we're in a very big gray area here, and it's a matter of intent. A rational ham radio operator is not revealing information and making a fortune on it, selling it as a service, and he's not doing it to create libel or to put the person in question at a disadvantage. No rational ham radio operator is going to do that. Therefore, I think you've got a little bit of leeway here of telling people that, yes, I set this up equipment. I set up this equipment. I listen to these astronauts while they're walking around on the lunar surface while they're setting up these experiments. This is what it sounds like. And it's not that different than what you heard when the networks are connected, except that I did hear some other things that were of technical interest to me when they're discussing battery voltages. And I've told you guys once before, the most fascinating thing I heard on Apollo 16, let me drop. Apollo 16 was Mattingly, Young, and Duke, and I'm not quite sure which astronaut it was, but they've got a very good sense of humor. And when they were about to go behind the moon for the first time and do that burn in order to do a lunar orbit injection burn, and all kinds of coordinates were being read up to the astronauts to be sure that their inertial platform was properly aligned. And about 3 seconds before there would be loss of signal as they go behind the moon the first time, one of the astronauts said to Houston, "Okay, Houston, at so-and-so mission elapsed time, I'm going to make a burn for 23 and a half seconds. Houston, do I make that burn toward the moon or away from the moon?" And he said that with just the proper timing so that Houston got loss of signal just as he finished answering that question. And so, in theory, the controllers in Houston had to bite their nails for 45 minutes until he came out from the other side of the moon to find out, was he kidding or was he telling the truth? Because if he did it in the wrong direction, it would be game over. So it just gives you a little bit of a hint of the kind of gallows humor these guys had. K2KEY, why don't you read the next one, Mel? K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, now it's getting kind of late, so I think we'll let it go anything further because we'll get into further discussion and we'll lose the audience. All right, so it's a very fine line, what you're saying. Because I understood just the final comments that there was a law that possession of equipment that can listen to cell phone technology was illegal. I also, like you say, you wrote to NASA. I can almost remember someplace where NASA said that it was forbidden for you to listen in on their communications, but I don't remember what the outcome, if they ever, you know, prosecuted anyone or whatever. I guess that you're not in jail, so it's the proof of the pudding. So let's go on with the TechNet pick, because it's 10 o'clock over.
Okay, Mel, a fun subject. The next guy on the list was Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Go right ahead, Joe. What would you like to discuss tonight? K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Joe got called away, or maybe he'll chime in a little later. Also, Les, K2TGW, Les, you signed in last week, and we didn't get to you last week. I wonder if you're available tonight.
And who are you?
BB2BXO.
Okay, I heard NNU and BXO in that order. Let's see, Alex, N2NNU, go right ahead, you first.
Okay, gentlemen, this is Yankee Oscar Stroke, November 2, November, November Uniform, transmitting from the coast of Black Sea. Having fun in here. Congratulations, Dick, for the new award that you got. So many, many years from now on coming. I would like to mention for Wesley that he seems that to forget that the Tesla coil is actually energy storage and delivery device. There's nothing else to it. So as such, the primary design for a Tesla coil is as fast delivery of the energy possible from it. Ferrite core will just hamper that and will not allow the Tesla coil to work. This is why most of the Tesla coils are on air coils. This is my 2 cents about Tesla. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Alex, I think, is signing in by way of Echo Link or one of the other internet connections. And thank you, Alex. And so I guess the next person is N2, is it BXO? N2 Baker, X-Ray Oscar. They've talked to you so often. And why in the world am I having trouble remembering your name? Over to you, sir. N2 BXO, K2RIW.
At least you make me bigger this time instead of older. Most people call me W2BXO, which makes me older than my dad. Anyway, this is WB2BXO, Frank, in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, tonight. Anyway, I had a question, and perhaps you've already discussed this exhaustively on an evening or at a time when I wasn't listening, and if you have, move on. I was wondering if you shed some light on the iPhone 4 fiasco, which apparently the RF deck and or antenna was not very well designed and was put behind a shield or something like that. And I think I've heard you mention a number of times that the digital engineers sometimes give the RF engineers about an inch of space to work with and don't realize that physics makes what the cell phone engineers want the antenna engineers to do if possible. I'm wondering if that's what happened there or whether somebody just plain made a mistake in manufacturing or something, as has been kind of suggested in the press. WB2BXO, Frank in Brooklyn. Go ahead, Dick.
Very fine, Frank. I made the mistake of listening and thought I heard N2BXO instead of WB2BXO. Now I know who you are. Sorry about that. And by the way, an earlier check-in was KC2JSN, and we're going to get to him right after you, Frank. So if he's still available, hang in there. In the case of the iPhone 4, which is a smaller and smaller package, in other words, when it comes to cell phones, it appears as though the public just can't get the cell phone small enough. They want it to be something that easily fits into their vest pocket or the shirt pocket, so to speak. And yet they want the biggest possible display and the best possible antennas. You remember that the early cell phones used to have a whip antenna you would pull out. And a hell of a lot of people wouldn't bother pulling out the whip antenna, and it still got operation. And then eventually the whip antenna got eliminated, and all the antennas became internal. So as you made smaller and smaller available volume for the antenna, the laws of physics of antenna design are such, let me drop, that you can make an antenna infinitesimal if you want to. You can make an antenna smaller and smaller, mechanically smaller. And there's all kinds of ways you can electronically lengthen the antenna by loading coils and top hat capacitors and meandering and whatever. There's lots and lots of ways, and there's electronic techniques you can also use. So whenever you devote less and less real estate for the antenna, you're going to pay a price. And the price is that it becomes much higher in Q and much more narrowband. And therefore, you suffer certain disadvantages. Well, because the package on the iPhone 4 is so darn small, when you listen to the very first presentation by Steve Jobs as he was announcing the availability of the iPhone 4 was going to take place in a week or so, he was bragging about the fact that the outer metallic ring, the metallic ring that supports the outer perimeter of the iPhone 4 was itself divided up into little bitty chunks, and it became the real antenna, a dipole-like antenna. And one of the cracks at the lower left-hand corner of that ring, let me drop, turned out to be the center of the main dipole that operates on the cell phone frequencies. So depending on how you hold the iPhone 4, there is the possibility that a finger or a thumb directly bridges the gap across the center of that dipole, and as such you detune the living daylights out of the antenna, and I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm guessing that the radiated signal strength goes down 10 or 15 decibels when you put your thumb in that area, and therefore depending on the distance between you and the local cell site, you can easily get a dropped call, and a certain percentage of the people buying the iPhone 4 ran into that problem and complained about it. a major solution, not a perfect solution, but the majority of the solution takes place by either using the bumper network that you put around it, or buying that so-called Band-Aid that a very crafty engineer decided to start selling. So by putting some kind of a insulating material over that crack,